Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Hello, everyone. What a pleasure to be here with Tayari Jones. I have a few little biographical things to state about her. I know that she is well known to most of the people in the audience, but she is a New York Times bestselling author, of course, of An American Marriage. Gorgeous novel, as well as three other novels. And she, of course, is an Oprah Book Club selection, which is quite an honor. Also, Barack Obama put her book on his summer reading list and his year roundup. Remember a time when presidents had reading lists. Can you imagine that? And also worth noting, An American Marriage won the Aspen Words Prize and an NAACP Image Award. And Tayari is currently a professor of creative writing at Emory University. So thank you for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
So I have some questions about the novel and some questions about your life and other things. And I thought I'd like to start with An American Marriage, and it's such a commentary on class in a lot of ways. I mean, it's many things. It's a complex novel, but I wondered if you could speak to what you hope to unpack, primarily with the relationship between the two characters coming from different class backgrounds.
You know, I read somewhere that most Americans don't know anyone from a different class background. And I was kind of stunned by that because I think, you know, particularly in communities of color and black communities in particular, you know, people from a different class background, we call them our cousins, right? Because of all the strides made in the civil rights movement, I'm born in 1970. So that means that my father grew up in the Jim Crow South. And actually, I have a sister that is 11 years older than me, so she was born in 59 in a small town in Louisiana. So that means I have a sister who came up under Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. So that I grew up with so many more advantages than she did just by virtue of being born 10 years later. So there's a lot of class, range within black families. Also, like if you go to a historically black college, you will find people there whose parents have been receiving education since, say, Reconstruction, who will be roommates with someone who's a first-generation college student. Whenever you have a first-generation college student, you change the class trajectory of a family. So we have Celestial and Roy, newlyweds. They met in college. He's a first-generation college student. Her father, like my father, has a PhD. And they're not considered, as the old people say, unevenly yoked in their marriage because this idea of class mobility is an important value in African-American community. However, there's a challenge to their relationship in that, you know, he feels like he is marrying the life he wants. And that also, I think, impacts gender because, how can I put this gently, but if women are ambitious in their marriage, people don't find it charming, right? Like when a man is ambitious in his marriage, they say, oh, look at him. He's punching above his weight, right? The people say that all the time. But if a woman looks at her marriage as part of her upward trajectory, yeah, people look at that askance, right? So I was kind of looking at the way that gender impacted their relationship and also region. Roy is from a small town and he migrates to Atlanta. We think of the Great Migration as people from small towns in the South moving to the promised land of the North and the West. But there's a lot of migration within the South, people from little towns who still want to live in the South, but they want to live in a bigger city. And they often are in the process of making these huge class leaps. And I just wanted to see the way that it affects ordinary people's lives. I should also say that it's kind of not directly autobiographical, but my father is from a little town in Louisiana, and he moved to Atlanta. He thought Atlanta was like the black promised land, because when I grew up in Atlanta, it was segregated, and I think Atlanta is still one of the hyper-segregated, well, some people describe it as hyper-segregated, and some people call them chocolate cities. It just depends on how you feel about that state of affairs. But when I grew up in Atlanta, it was such a black space that I did not know that. I knew intellectually that America was majority white, but I didn't believe it. You know, it's like the way they tell you that the earth is 80% water. And you're like, I guess, but then how am I sitting here if this place is 80% water? That's how I felt. And so class was so important in understanding divisions because race wasn't the thing on the table. Mm-hmm. I don't think I knew an actual, genuine white person until I was about 19 years old.
Wow, yeah. It's...
His name was Chuck.
Perfect. I'm wondering if mass incarceration or wrongful incarceration was something that you sought out or if that topic chose you.
I just have one other thing to say. When I was so I met this person named Chuck when I was 19. When I was 20, I moved to Iowa, and then I had no trouble believing that. incarceration has, I think that they call it mass incarceration because it happens to so many people, and I do feel that it's just woven into the culture. So did I find it? Did it find me? Because of the reality of incarceration, it's become almost mundane that I didn't have to get struck by lightning to write this book. I always say that sometimes books find you like a lightning bolt, but when it comes to questions of incarceration, I feel like it's always raining. So I decided to write about it. I don't know. I didn't have that kind of moment like, oh, this is a huge problem that should be written about. I did decide for my fourth novel that I wanted to engage with the world in a different way than I had with my earlier books. With my earlier books, I had written largely drawing from my autobiography. The first book is about growing up in Atlanta during the Atlanta child murders. When I was a child in Atlanta, 28 black children were killed, and two of them were students at my elementary school. So I feel like that was my first novel, that's my obvious story. And, you know, I wrote my third novel about two sisters who have the same dad, a different mom. Well, that's also true in my life, another one of my obvious stories. But I had a very hard time publishing my third novel. I couldn't find a publisher for it. I had written the two other books. I felt good about them. I knew that I wasn't rich. A person notices that she is not rich, right? A person notices that she is not a bestseller. But I felt like I was doing the work that was important to me, and I was grateful to be publishing and doing what I loved. But my publisher dropped me because in between when I wrote my first book and my third book, computers had come into everyday use in a different kind of way. And there's this computer program called BookScan. You know BookScan?
Yeah, BookScan,
they can put your name in a computer and know exactly how many books you've sold. They can take your life's work and distill it to a number. And my numbers were not good. And I didn't know they were that bad. I mean, I knew they weren't good, but I didn't know that. Anyway, so the publisher dumped me. Right. And I couldn't, and I was told that I would never publish again unless I started writing under a pseudonym.
Wow.
And I just refused to not use my name. Mm. So anyway, I wrote the third book thinking it would never be published, and through a series of kind of miraculous events, I was able to find a publisher for my third book. And so when it was time for my fourth book, I asked myself why I had been given this opportunity to publish, why had this been returned to me, and I was asking what was I meant to write about instead of writing so much as like what soothes my heart, like why had God returned this to me, and I decided that I wanted to engage something bigger, and incarceration just seemed to be the obvious thing to address.
Well, and I wonder if you might share with the audience the story that you've told in other places about the inspiration, seeing the couple at the mall, and that does seem like it was a bit of a lightning moment, at least delivering you a framework.
Well, I wrote this grant to go to Harvard to do research on incarceration. I was accepted. I moved to Cambridge. I lived there. And that's how dedicated I was to doing this research on this topic. And I did all this research, and I learned a lot about incarceration. I learned statistics that broke my heart. Like, one is that 1 in 28 first graders in this country has an incarcerated parent. You know, and how does that ripple out? What does that do for the coming of age of an entire generation? So I learned these things, but I wasn't inspired to write fiction. I didn't have a story. I had a problem. I had statistics that kept me up at night. I was angry. I was walking around angry, and I was telling everybody, you know, shocking statistics when they'll be trying to talk about something else happy. And I was like, how dare you be happy? Did you know? So But I didn't have a story. And just imagine, the people at Harvard, they wanted us to give a presentation of our work. I had been working, but I didn't have any work to show. And I was really anxious, too, because I felt like it would reflect badly on everyone like me if I had not, if I didn't seem to be using this time at Harvard well. But what could I do? What could I do? So I went home to Atlanta to visit my mother, which is something that I do when I have things on my mind. And while I was there, I also went to the mall, which is something that I do when I have things on my mind. And while I was at the mall, I went to the food court, which is also something that I do when I have things on my mind. And while I was there at the food court, I saw a couple. She was beautifully dressed, shoes, bag, belt, everything. She looked fantastic. And she was with a man, and he looked okay. He looked fine, but she looked great. And I could tell that they were in love and in trouble. And they were having like really kind of heated words. And I heard her say, clear as a bell, she said, Roy, you know you wouldn't have waited on me for 7 years. And I looked at her, I looked at him, they looked at me. And I felt like all three of us knew good and well that he would not have waited on her for 7 years. But he looked kind of taken aback and he said, I don't know what you're talking about. This wouldn't have happened to you in the first place. And I felt like he was right. And I felt, for me, I know I have a novel when I have a situation where the characters disagree, but nobody's lying, nobody's wrong. And that's when I decided to write a novel about a young couple separated by the husband's wrongful incarceration. Before, I was trying to write about wrongful incarceration, but novels come from the place of moral ambiguity. And there is no moral ambiguity in wrongful incarceration. You know why they call it wrongful incarceration? Because it's wrong. And there's really nothing else to say about that.
And this novel is so gorgeous. So you really ask your readers to step into the different characters. And just as you said, it would never have happened to Celestial. She wouldn't have been in that situation. This is what happened to Roy because he's a Black man. And yet as the work unfolds, you do find yourself stepping into both of their perspectives to say, would I do that? What would my response be? And I saw a review on Instagram that said, this couple, they just weren't good for each other. They weren't a good match. And I totally disagreed with that. I thought they were a good match in so many ways. And so how did you think about that complexity? And do you think Roy and Celestial should have ended up together?
I feel like, were they a good match? I think they were a decent match. I think they were in love. I think their relationship was kind of tumultuous. But I think that when you say, okay, I'm going to write a novel about a couple separated by a wrongful conviction, that this book, there was a lot of, I had to really struggle with what I call the tyranny of genre expectation. When I lay out that plot, you think they're going to be a perfect couple. It should be like Dateline. Y'all watch Dateline? Dateline. I used to watch Dateline, but it was undermining my faith in humanity. But, you know, it all starts out like they were the perfect couple. Beautiful, handsome. They had everything. And then disaster struck. But I feel that that type of construct for a novel like this is also playing into a kind of problematic respectability politics in having to make them perfect so that the injustice that happens to them reads as an injustice. But I think that for a novel, they had to be a couple that would be interesting enough in their coupleness that even had disaster not struck, you would want to read about them. And what makes relationships interesting, I feel like perfect relationships are only interesting to the people in them. Think about it. When your friends are having a perfect, you don't really want to hear it. You know, you acknowledge them. But when your friend says, girl, you won't believe what happened, you're like, no, tell me everything. I'm here for you. And so that was also a decision I made for the readability of the novel, that they be more average and have their ups and downs. And also it makes it where when this thing happens to them, they have to decide what to do. The question isn't, do we preserve the perfect love? Mm-hmm. They're just regular people.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. And I'd like to go into what you were saying, like, you know, when you don't have money. 2 weeks ago, you were in New York on a money panel. I thought that was interesting, and I watched it. And I wondered if you could tell a little bit about why you've chosen to speak on that topic, because there's also a piece online on Cut, and you're kind of talking about the difference between going from not being a best-selling author to being a best-selling author, and that's really different in terms of income and how you feel about yourself. And you said an interesting thing, which is that self-sufficiency is a liability in women, I'm guessing. Maybe you think in particular for Black women. So it's a big question, but if you could talk about money, why you're speaking on that topic, and then also what you meant by self-sufficiency as a liability.
Well, the people from The Cut, they were doing this thing on women and money, and they wanted me to talk about, you know, what it is to have a life-changing moment. You know, my book was chosen, by Oprah, and it sold more books in its first week than my other books had sold together over 15 years. And what did that mean? And when they were talking, when they first brought this up to me, you know, writers, if you write a novel, you don't really see any money for almost a year after that. So it's like you're living this life where people think you have money, you haven't seen a dime of it yet. Like, I was living in an apartment in Brooklyn so small that if I fell out of the bed, I would land in a bathtub. And other people were like, your apartment is so huge. Because that's just how it is there. I'm from the South where, you know, we are used to having more space. But I felt like living in Brooklyn, the way that I was living, was one of the many sacrifices I made for my writing. I never imagined that I would make any money from my writing. And I never really aimed for that. I wanted to be read, is what I wanted. But they asked me to talk about money, and I think they thought that I would tell them a story all about taking shopping sprees and, you know, enjoying. I felt like they were talking to me like they thought I was Oprah. I'm like, no, that's not the way writing and money works. But I also thought it was important to talk about, like, as a Black woman, I am never more than a degree of separation from someone who needs money very badly, right? Like I was saying about this generational thing, my dad has a PhD, but my daddy literally picked cotton as a boy. So in terms of years, there's not a lot of distance between me and, you know, people who actually, you know, are living, you know, below the poverty line. I have relatives who live below the poverty line. So when I had this experience, you know, I bought a house, and I had to buy furniture for the whole house because my apartment in Brooklyn is about the size of this stage, and this is about how much furniture I had in it. And now I have a house to fill up, and I had to go buy furniture for all the rooms. And I thought that it would be so much fun buying all this stuff, but it wasn't, because every time I would look at something, I would think there's someone in my life that needs this more all the time. So it wasn't pleasurable in the way that I thought it would. And I also felt like being able to buy all these things at once, it made my life different from the lives of the people I love. And every time something happens that gives you less in common with the people you love, it puts space between you.
Thank you. I mean, I think it's a really courageous topic to speak about. And I found some of the things that you were saying about it quite interesting. And it kind of jumps back to Celestial. Her job is so particular, kind of precious in a way. How did you choose that? And do you equate it to your own pursuit of writing in some ways?
Celestial makes dolls. She's an artist. I wanted to write about a woman artist. I had never read a novel with a Black woman artist at the center, and I needed an art form for her. I have a good friend who makes dolls. Her dolls are so beautiful. She can spend years on them. She's, you know, has damaged her vision doing that intricate needlework. But at the end of the day, when she makes her dolls, people regard them as toys for girls. And I think that's the experience in many ways of women artists, this idea that no matter what you do, in some ways you're making toys for girls. People assume that I've written a romance novel often when I say I've written a book. And then when I say no, I've written a novel about the collateral effects of wrongful incarceration, I've had people say, oh, then I'll buy that for my wife. Mm. Or they, you know, like there's this sense that women's art is not rigorous, it's not valuable. There is a sense that when you're a woman artist and your art is consumed primarily by women, then that it must not be rigorous. So that was interesting to me with Celestial and her dolls. And I was also interested in what I call the ethics of portrait making, because her dolls look like the people in her life. And it's just like when you write a character that reminds you of a real person, sometimes that person likes it, sometimes that person doesn't like it. You don't know how they're going to react. And what are the ethics of that? I mean, sometimes people feel like you've stolen their life for your book. But I always say, I didn't steal your life. You're still living your life. So obviously I didn't steal it. But they feel like you have, like you've exposed them in some way, even though you don't identify them. So it's a really tricky thing about how much real life and what the costs are. For me personally, if I feel that something I want to write will devastate someone that matters to me, I won't write it. I won't put it in there. I know there are other people who feel like the art above all else, but I think that if you have anything that's your job or your work or whatever, and you put it above the people in your life, for me, that is not the way that I rank the important things for myself.
Hmm. I'd like to stay on Celestial for just a moment because there's so much conversation. You've talked about it, but in the culture at large, about this lack of diverse expression for Black women in particular. And you hear about it in the movies and you hear about it in literature. The book is so much about Roy, but Celestial is such a compelling, complex character who has to make hard decisions and who really gets blamed in so many ways by so many different people in her life. So how did you approach her, and what's your relationship, what was or is your relationship with her?
I had a really hard time writing Celestial as a character because I think part of it is what I call the tyranny of genre expectation. If I say I've written a book about a woman and her husband is wrongfully incarcerated, you're like, oh, it's going to be one woman's brave fight to free her man. Like, that's the way that we understand that role of that woman that's left behind. You know, there's an expression to say, like, if your husband is in prison, you too are doing time, but on the outside. I mean, that's something I read about a lot. But I think it is true that people whose loved ones are incarcerated suffer, but there's also this need to make his plight her plight, like elevating her by the idea that she is sharing his suffering vicariously. So that means that his suffering is still at the center of how we understand her life. And so when I wrote a novel that kind of interrogated this a little bit, like, some people got really, really mad at me. Like mad. Just the idea of it. But like that, when I would suggest that Celestial as an artist may want to pursue her own dreams, and I wasn't writing a novel to punish her for that, I got just so much negative feedback that I had to stop showing the book to my early readers because we were going to not be friends anymore, because this is how mad they were. I think that when you write a novel and the novel is doing something different, when the novel is not quite finished and it's not quite right, people say something's not right about this book, and I think you should make it more conventional to fix that problem. But when you get it together and you get it finished, people can appreciate that you did something different. But something different that's unfinished is a really difficult thing to deal with, particularly when you have genre expectation. I mean, I was looking at how much women are respected because of their ability to sacrifice. Like, that's what makes them valuable. And the extent to which they can serve the struggles of other people, that's a way that a woman can be respected. Like, if this novel was about Celestial, her husband goes to prison, and she doesn't pursue her art, she doesn't do anything else but try to get him free, and we watch her life fall to pieces, yet she soldiers on for her man, I feel like that would have been that's an expected story, and it's a way that we're used to valuing women. But when I have her, she wants to get him out, her family pays for his lawyers, but she is pursuing her career. He's mad at her. Her daddy is mad at her. Everyone in the world is so angry at her. And book clubs. Anybody in here in a book club? Did your book club read the book? Did someone in your book club get really mad at her? See, I know. They get really, really, really angry. And I sometimes think that if we can't imagine a way forward for imaginary people, because Roy and Celestial are imaginary, what hope is there for real people with real lives?
Well, thank you for writing Celestial. I thought she was fantastic. Yes. Back before An American Marriage, there was a piece on Feminist Wire asking you who you thought your readership was. So this was after Silver Sparrow, and you said, in more words than this, but basically middle-class black women or women who could see themselves in your story. And I wonder if that feels different to you now with An American Marriage. I mean, more than 500,000 copies in print, 15 different languages, like clearly it's transcended. And do you think about that? Having a crossover audience?
When I wrote my first book in 2002, I had a very small readership, and it's been really interesting. I wrote my first novel 17 years ago, and I had a small, dedicated audience of mostly black women readers who took such good care of me. I mean, I would come to a book event, and there'd be like 7 people there, and they would say, can we take you to dinner afterwards? Like, they were just so kind to me and write letters to me. When I moved to New Jersey, and this is back when I had no book contract, when I was told my career was over. I moved to New Jersey, and I received a package in the mail, and it was an afghan that had been crocheted for me by a black woman reader. And she says, it's so cold up there in the north. I want you to have this, to keep you warm while you write your next book. Like, she was waiting on my next book. And that has always meant so much to me, the readers who were there for me. When my books were hard to get because the publisher had been sold, they put the books on print on demand. And that time it's so important to me. So yes, now I have a much wider readership. I don't like to think that I've transcended though, because I feel that I never want my original readership to feel like they were a stepping off point for me to go on to something bigger or better. There's nothing bigger or better than them. And that's important to me.
And staying in before, I was on the way over here, I said there's kind of a before and an after when you have a big book like this. And I'm curious if before, because I know you because you did this column for She Writes for a while called Surviving the Draft. So before An American Marriage, were you out there hustling? I mean, did you have to do things to get your name out, or was that not something you were so concerned about?
When I first started writing, there was no such thing as social media, right? When I first started writing, it's back when you were a writer, you would have like postcards made up and like leave the postcards places and hope. I don't even know how we thought this was going to work. We thought like someone would see the postcard, pick it up and go buy your book. I don't know what we thought, but I didn't. So there was no means to really hustle to get your name out there. If you didn't have access to the media, there was really no way. I was taught that whatever writerly problem you have, there's only one solution to every writerly problem, which is to write the next book, which is still true now. Like, I've written this book, it's a bestseller, et cetera, et cetera. But you know what I need to go home and do? I need to write the next book. Let's say I had written this book and it wasn't a bestseller and I wanted to try to get my name out there. You know what I would have to do? Write the next book. I mean, that's what the whole thing is about, trying to write the next book. I think all these other things are procrastination. They're ways you're furthering your career, perhaps, but you're not furthering your art. And it is the art that will win out in the end. So it's all about writing the next book.
Awesome. I can't wait for the next one. So
I am so stressed. I mean, this is for the first time in my adult life, I'm not really working on anything. I've been working on a book in some form since I was about 19 years old. And that is one thing. I've been on the road pretty continuously for 18 months. Wow. And I miss writing, and I miss slipping into a fictional world. And I do feel the pressure of, like, An American Marriage took me 6 years to write. It was 4 years overdue. But there wasn't a lot of pressure because it wasn't a big priority for my publisher. They would occasionally ask me about the book, and I would feel embarrassed, but I didn't feel pressured. Although, my editor lived 2 blocks from me, and I would see her in the grocery store. I was so embarrassed. I would like hide behind the rotisserie chickens. And I would hear her kids saying, "I saw her, mommy, I saw her." It's like, shut up, Caleb. Nobody's talking to you. But it was stressful. But now there's like, where's the next book is a really different kind of question, because I have a reputation in a different way now than I did before. And I want to go back to that kind, sometimes I want to go back to that innocent place where when I wrote my first book, I didn't know anything about publishing. This was like in the early 2000s when you had to mail the book in. You had to print out 15 copies and mail it in. And I couldn't afford to print it so many times because it was like 10 cents a page at Kinko's. And so I like printed out pages and I would give it to my friends and say, would you take these 20 pages to your job and just make me 5 copies? And I had all these stacks of all these different pages until I had them all together. And then you had to mail them in a book box, a box, a manuscript box. And to get a manuscript box, you had to buy a box of boxes. And it was 20 boxes and a box of boxes. They were expensive. I couldn't get anybody to go in with me on the 20 boxes. I thought, well, maybe I'll mail it in a cereal box because it's the right shape. But then I thought that would look country. I mean, I was not a sophisticated early reader. I was not, you know, my name wasn't out there. I wasn't hustling. But I wrote the book in a completely innocent place because I didn't know anything about trends or what agents want. All I knew was the story in my heart. And I used to say, oh, I want to get back to that innocent place where I wrote my first book, where I had no market pressure. And then when I time for write my third book, my contract was canceled and I couldn't get arrested. And I finished writing my third book. I was in the innocent place again because I was told I would have no career. And so I wrote the book only because I felt it needed to be written. But after that, I stopped saying that I want to get back to that place. So I don't want to be back to that place. I don't want to be in that kind of place where publishers don't matter because, you know, I'm on the outside. But I do want to get back to where I just put one word in front of the other, in front of the other, and tune out everything else.
I hope you can find that in Atlanta. Who have you been? I mean, you started writing a long time ago, and it sounds like you were just on this true pursuit of literature and being a novelist from early on. Who were your primary literary inspirations?
In real life or on the page?
Either. Either
way, different,
both.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, I first met a writer when I was a student at Spelman College. I met a writer, and she was my teacher. There was a class in creative writing. I did not know before this you could take a class in creative writing. I thought writers just wrote. I didn't know it could be formally taught. And I saw there was a class available, and I wanted to take it. But the class was only available to upperclassmen, juniors and seniors. And I was a freshman. Not only was I a freshman, I was the youngest freshman in the class. I was 16. And I couldn't take the class. And I thought this was discrimination. And I, you know, this was before computers, when you could take a class, you had to, if you wanted to take a class you didn't have the prerequisite for, you just needed an advisor's signature on a little piece of paper. Like now I think this would be on computers, but it was just a little piece of paper. And I had seen the advisor's signature. It wasn't much of a signature. It was like a squiggle. And I thought that were I to sign that myself, that it could, in a way, be interpreted as civil disobedience. So I civilly disobeyed. And I took a creative writing class from, she's a playwright, Pearl Clegg. She's also a novelist. But I took her class, and she took me under her wing, and she kind of modeled a writing life and taught me that you write a story that your heart feels needs to be written. And she never talked about the business angle or awards or reviews. It was always about what is your relationship to your readers. And she is still my mentor to this day, but she really was kind of my North Star. I should say, sidebar, I was caught in my civil disobedience, by the way. And the professor who was the advisor, she was like an English teacher you imagine, with the glasses down on the nose with the chain. And she said, she held up the card. She said, young lady, do you know what this is? And I was like, it's an override card, ma'am. She says, it is fraud. But she ultimately said, though, she said that if a young person wants to learn something so badly that she would commit fraud and risk expulsion, she must want to learn indeed. And she did not make me withdraw from the class. And that remains the greatest gift of my life.
That's amazing. And what about authors? I mean, maybe one at least.
Well, I feel like my obsession with Toni Morrison is well documented. I think she is the greatest American writer I think like ever. People often say that people compare her to Faulkner. But when people compare Toni Morrison to Faulkner, I hope they understand that the honor belongs to Faulkner.
Agreed. Thank you. Now you teach creative writing. I mean, you've been teaching creative writing. What is your favorite part about teaching, and has that changed now with all of the expectations of the travel and other things going on in the aftermath of An American Marriage?
I love teaching. I'm looking at one of my students right here. Raise your hand, Serena. I love seeing my students when I'm on the road. I feel like teaching, you know, teaching is a family business. My parents are both professors. So I grew up in the academy. When I was a child, I thought graduate students were a type of cousin. So I would see friends of mine with like youngish adult people, and I would say, oh, is that your graduate student? And they would just like be confused. But so, I mean, I've always understood that teaching is a kind of service that we do. And teaching often makes it where I think about writing all the time, because I'm talking about writing all the time. And I feel like my students keep me honest. When I was having all those publishing troubles with my third book, I think the reason that I kept writing is because I teach. And if I teach my students what was taught to me, that you write the story that needs to be written, how could I face them if I had given up on my book because I was told I couldn't publish it? So in order for me to have to feel honest when I stand before them, I have to be doing my own work. So they are a motivator for me, actually. Now I teach undergraduates, which is different than graduate students. I find teaching undergraduates is a special, its own delight, because undergraduates, they're not professionalized yet. They're experimenting, they're finding themselves, and they write really kooky stories. And I enjoy their company. I really do.
That's great. I'm looking for my timer, who seems to have disappeared, and you're wearing a watch. Are we doing on time?
I'm a very analog person. It's in New York, it's 10 after 5.
Okay, great. I want to make sure that the audience gets to Q&A. I think we're getting close. I'm going to ask a couple more questions with that, with the New York time in mind. So there's, if you look at your writing, I mean, it strikes me anyway that any woman who writes strong female characters will be called a feminist writer. Reading about you online, there's a lot of references to feminism and black feminism, but not much said about it. And I'm curious about your stance on that. You know, does that feel true? You know, is it something that you set out to do? And how does that play into what might be gender-based expectations that you face as a woman novelist?
I feel like my worldview, which is definitely a feminist worldview, it's an intersectionally feminist worldview, is going to be in everything I write without me trying, because it's how I understand the world. I feel that in our fiction, we tell on ourselves, we really reveal what we think is important and what our expectations are. And also, I feel like in fiction, we put forth what we hope to manifest. So I think that. But I was really challenged in writing An American Marriage, because when I was trying to write it all from the point of view of Celestial, there was just so much pushback. What about her husband? What about her husband? And I felt like, what about her husband? Like, I felt really kind of mad that everyone's saying that her story isn't a story without his story. And I just resisted. But then I wrote Roy's point of view from beginning to end. It took me about 6 months. I had spent a year and a half writing Celestial, but I wrote Roy in 6 months, and I was suspicious of it. See, some people say that writing should feel like love, and if it comes easy, then it's real. See, I believe that writing is like love, and if it comes easy, you should be very suspicious. But I realized that the reason that I was able to write Roy's part in such a short period of time is that Roy's story is a story I've known all my life. A man against the system, and he just wants to come home and find a faithful woman, you know, in a clean house or something. Like, that's a story we've known forever. That is the Odyssey, right? And the Odyssey, that's what, like 75 BC? That was a long time ago. So,
that I realized, and I didn't want to just write like a black reboot of the Odyssey. So I realized, though, that Celestial in many ways is Penelope. It's as if Odysseus comes home and Penelope not only has not been unweaving her tapestry, she's now a famous tapestry artist. And he has to figure out where is his place in that and what does that mean. And so I felt like, oh yes, this is definitely a feminist reimagining of a story we already know. But, you know, it has been very gratifying to be in the journey with this book. And to, even though, I mean, sometimes book clubs or people in audiences are really mad at me and really mad at Celestial. I mean, at my event earlier today, I was talking about this lady in Baltimore who was about to come up on the stage. She was so mad at me and mad at Celestial. And the other person on the panel was saying, well, ma'am, it's only fiction. And she shook that cane. She says, yes, but I know what you think. And she was right. She was 100% right in what she thought that I thought. And I could have hid behind the idea like, oh, it's only fiction. But she was understanding my worldview as put forth in this book. And she was resisting that. She just kept screaming at me, you have to stand by your man. You have to take care of your man. And I was arguing in this book that the question is much more complicated. And I wanted to suggest in this book, which is, I think, a feminist idea, that what Celestial has to offer to the world and to Roy is more than mere fidelity or loyalty or chastity. Like, one woman's chastity is not the remedy for an offense committed by the state. And she knew what I was thinking. That's why she was mad at me. And so I was willing to, although it was very uncomfortable, I was willing to stand there and take her anger, because I felt that the fact that she was so angry meant that we were moving this conversation forward. Any meaningful conversation is going to involve anger.
Yes, please. Thank you. Well, and I mean, I hate to spoil endings, but I think it's important.
Ma'am.
Hold on, tell me first.
No, okay, we can't. Who hasn't finished the book? Oh my goodness, people. I want to see a queue out there in a half hour. You got to take this book home with you. Okay, I can't ask that question.
Wait, maybe we can rephrase it. What were you going to say? One second. What about them?
Got it. I'm going to reframe it. It's okay. Simply about Roy, when he gets out of prison, does have essentially what starts out as a one night stand with.
Okay. Okay.
I just want to ask.
I got you. Trust me.
She's got it.
Okay. I was interested. Roy is from a small town, and he feels like he's escaped his small town by moving to Atlanta and marrying Celestial, you know, who's from a more well-off family, kind of more sophisticated. And when he gets out of prison on page 87, so that's why I don't think it's a spoiler. It's early. But he meets another woman, and it was important to me that this woman from his hometown, you know, she went to high school with him, she works in the local Walmart, but that I had never really read very much where a black woman, working woman, she works at Walmart, is desirable, and is not used as some kind of empty foil for the other characters, or like some kind of exclusively nurturing space. I really needed Roy to see the value and the beauty in his home and the people he grew up with, and know that home is not just something that you escape. That home forms you, and that there's love and value there. That was important for me in his relationship with her.
Thank you. Perfect. That is what I wanted to know. We are going to move to audience questions. And do we have a mic runner? Yes. Great. So the runner is going to come. Please do ask questions. We get a lot of comments in this town.
I saw this first.
I'm okay with comments.
Comments that end in questions. Okay, so start with a comment and end with a question. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Honored to be here. My question is around your edited volume of the Atlanta Noir with Tanner Ivedu. I know you talked about the limitations of genre, but I'm interested in what you're doing around noirist fiction and how you've used that to commentate on Black folks' experience with the city, particularly in the wake of displacement and gentrification. Thank you.
I really love the noir series. I did Atlanta Noir, but you know they have them for almost for cities all over the world. And one of the things in that volume is that you can define noir however you want to as an editor. And I was really interested in the way that everyday people encounter darkness, the way that we encounter the way crime is just like in the background of our lives, even if it's not a crime story. One of my theories is that Atlanta itself as a city, Atlanta is a crime scene, right? It's a site, you know, Civil War battles. Atlanta is a crime scene, and we're building on top. The city is being, in some ways, built on top of a grave. And how does the past, I feel like the past infects the present in a way that renders everything that happens there to be noir. I'm working, kind of trying to work on a new book. Look at me, got me talking about, that's not slick. Now I'm talking about the new book. About gentrification. I'm trying to write a novel about a woman who comes home to Atlanta, just as I've come home to Atlanta. Where I live in Atlanta, it's not the Atlanta I knew, and the neighborhood where I'm living is not the neighborhood it was when I grew up there. And my real emotional question to myself is, can you gentrify your own neighborhood? What does that mean to come home now?
Okay.
Hi, so first of all, thank you for that. This has been wonderful. I wanted to ask you about the ending, and I'm not going to spoil it for those who haven't read it. But there is a moment at the end where I feel like it all comes together very
neat. I am so nervous. Okay, what?
I just wanted to ask you about the piece where, like, Roy at the end seems to be at peace with everything. And
keep it high level.
With everything that's happened, and I'm not going to say what happened, and like, how did you think about finishing it and, you know, tying a lot of feelings that were going on in that book together?
It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. You're in good hands. I got you. I got you. I realize it took me a year to write the last 50 pages of this book because I misunderstood the book. Despite the fact that, like I was saying, that I was resisting trying to tell this kind of traditional male narrative, I was allowing Roy, the character, to tell me what this book is about. Roy thinks this book is about how he can regain all that he's lost. He's lost his job, his car, his woman, his house. And he thinks the moral measure of the universe, he thinks the moral measure of everyone around him is who can give him back these things that he's lost. That's what he thinks this book is about. That's what he thinks his life is about. That's what he thinks justice is about. But what he really lost, I realized, was his own citizenship and his own life. And by citizenship, the way that we are citizens is what we contribute to the society in which we live. And he forgot. He has been so downtrodden by his experience of being incarcerated that he forgot that he can ask what he can do for other people, what he can contribute. And so that is how he experiences his own salvation, is realizing that he has something to give. When you think you have nothing to give, then you are not a part of your own life anymore. You're not a part of your family. You're not a part of your society. You're not a contributing member. And he may not have money anymore. He may not have his car. He may not have all these things, but there is something he can do for others. And once he realizes that, the book could finish. I couldn't finish the book before I realized that, because there's no way he could get the time back that he lost. There's no way that by virtue of his suffering, he can get everyone else in his life to organize their lives around replenishing what he has lost. It's impossible. And when I thought the book would be about the fact that he can't get back what he's lost, that is such a hopeless ending. And I am a writer who imagines a reader who has experienced the things I'm writing about, and I could not present that imaginary reader with a hopeless ending. I feel it's irresponsible to write without hope. And so I was stuck for a year trying to figure out where the hope was, but it was in his contribution. And I came to that, hear me out, By listening to the words of Mick Jagger. Because you know what Mick Jagger told us? You can't always get what you want, but sometimes you get what you need.
What are some of the less obvious things that you could be writing about, but maybe you are shying away from, or that are too deeply embedded that you're not ready yet to write about?
And I'm going to tell you on a microphone. You know, but I think that, but I do think that I sometimes, unbeknownst to myself, am working up to other topics. Like when I wrote my third novel, Silver Sparrow, about the two girls with the same dad, I realized that all my books were writing about people with a paternal sibling that they didn't really know, and asking myself what makes family family and what is the responsibility of the second generation to fix the problems caused by the earlier generations. You know, I am a person, I have a sister, and we have the same dad, different moms. We weren't raised together. And all my life, I felt like I had a sister. But when I turned my head, there was no one there. And I was afraid to write about that head on because I didn't want to upset my family, et cetera, et cetera. So I realized now that I was inching up on that story, that I was sneaking up on it. So I wonder if there's another story now that is creeping up on me that I don't see yet. But I will just say one other thing about that for people who may be considering writing something and you're worried about how other people are going to respond. When I wrote Silver Sparrow, I wrote it as honestly as I could on what it felt like to, you know, have a sister and not have a sister, what it felt like to enjoy privileges that she didn't have. And I was so afraid that, you know, that my family would be upset. But no one was upset because I tried my best to tell an honest story and to write each character from a point of view where I understood them and made it where no one was all bad, no one was all good. I felt like because I wrote honestly that everyone felt that I had done right by them and nobody was upset. So don't be afraid of your own stories. Just tell them fully and it should be okay.
Thank you so much. I'm also a Spelman graduate, and I was wondering if you could talk about a little bit more about the impact of going to a historically black college on your writing and also going to a women's college and how Spelman shaped the writer that you became.
Thank you. So nice to see you here. Going to Spelman College, I love to say going to Spelman College was the best decision my mother ever made for me. Because it wasn't my idea to go to Spelman. I was from Atlanta, and I didn't want to go to school in Atlanta because I told my mother, I said, Mommy, the whole purpose of going to college is to get away from your family. And she said, well, what if my mother's very calm. She's like, what if your father and I were moving away? How would you feel about that? And I was like, oh, that's different. And so I went. That's how I ended up going to Spelman. I think about how easily I could have gone somewhere else. I had actually sent in my deposit to go to Dillard University in New Orleans. I had saved my little money. This is back in the day when you could buy a money order. I had bought my money order and sent in my deposit because I was like, mama's not going to keep me, you know, from fulfilling my dream of going to Dillard. I don't know why I wanted to go to Dillard. I feel like college is such an important decision left up to kids, you know? But so I went to Spelman, and for the first time, when I went, I'm a class of 91, Johnetta Cole was president, and she was the first black woman president of this black women's college. This was in 1987. Can you believe how recent that is? And it was the first time I had ever seen black women truly in charge of anything. And I felt so validated, seen, contextualized. I was walking, I'll never forget, I was walking across campus and there was Dr. Cole. This is back in the 80s. Remember people used to think you could walk really fast and lose weight? Remember that in the 80s? Like you would walk really fast. And she was wearing sweats. They had Spelman down the leg and she was doing that thing where you walk fast and move your arms. And she saw me and she had that big booming voice, you know, and she said, Tayari, how is the writing? No one had ever asked me that question before, and I wanted to rise up so the next time I saw her, I would have something to say back. Because for someone like her to turn her light on me, I just felt I felt like a different person. And at Spelman, there were so many Black women doing so many different things. There were so many different ways to be popular, to be important, that I felt that the options before me were really unlimited. And this is why, I mean, ever since I graduated from Spelman, when I was like just in my first year out, I sent $10 a month to just try to give back to the place that had given so much to me.
Thank you for that. That's very inspiring. I wonder what that call was like. Can you talk about when you heard that you were on Oprah's list and on Obama's reading list?
Yeah. Well, of the many, I'm sure there are more pleasures of being Oprah than we can imagine, but among the pleasures of being Oprah, I think, is that she likes to roll up on people and change their life. So she doesn't give you any warning. You're just minding your business. I was driving my car, and there was a block call. I'm a person that answers block calls because I feel like every block call is a story. Like somebody blocked that call for a reason. Usually it's not a good reason, but there was a block call, and I answered it. I said, hello, and the voice on the other end said, hey, girl, this is Oprah. Now, you know, Oprah's from Mississippi, and I'm from Georgia, so I said, ma'am? And she said that she wanted to use my book for her book club, and what did I think about that? And I said, yes, ma'am, I think that would be nice. And then I put the hazard lights on, and I pulled over. Now, I was in Las Vegas, because I was on fellowship at UNLV. I was in Las Vegas, and if you've been to Vegas, you know there's the Strip, and there's the rest. I was in the rest. And so I pulled over and all these people, like panhandling people, were like knocking on my window, you know, and I'm trying to talk to Oprah and I'm like shooing them away. But it was really meaningful to me because it took, so in between when Oprah called me and the book came out, it was 5 months and I couldn't tell anyone. So people would say to me, how's the book coming? I was like, oh, I'm hopeful. I think this one might get some attention. But I had to really think about the fact that Oprah Winfrey literally put her name on my book, her good name. And I, cause you know, we had to like decide what color the O should be on the front. You know, like she literally put her name on my book. But it also made me think about all through my life, how many people had put up their good name for me. They may not be Oprah. Their name doesn't have that kind of weight, but their name means as much to them as Oprah's name means to her. And I really thought about my 12th grade English teacher, Miss Cathcart, and that she wrote a letter for me to go to Spelman, and she signed her good name on that letter. And I just thought of all the ways that so many of us have stood up for one another in the ways that we could. And I felt very surrounded and very loved. So by the time that the Oprah's announcement came, like I said, it was 5 months, I felt at peace and I felt protected.
What about Obama?
Obama, that one was different. First off, they don't call you. You just find out. But, you know, the Obama thing was exciting because it was so legible to everyone. Just like Oprah's name is legible. Like a lot of things that accomplishments you have in the writing world, people don't know what it is, right? Like if you say, oh, I won a pen award, they'll be like, oh, great. Must be a nice pen. Like they don't know, but people know Oprah. They know Obama. And like my dad, he was very pleased with the Oprah, but he was impressed with Obama. And so he started calling me 00 Jones.
Thank you so much for writing your book. And one of the things
I hear you, but I don't see you.
Okay. One of the things that really impressed me is how you touched upon class markers and differences in the Black community without explicitly saying that. And I'm curious about the way that you drew both Celestial's and Roy's parents and how they kind of attended to the situation. How you thought about that in terms of like their situation and where they're from and how they reacted to what was happening to their children.
I was really interested in the generational question of marriage, the way that, because I think the generational question of marriage in this book is kind of similar This is going to be a little bit of a meander, but I'm going to come back to it. It's similar to the generational question, I think, even about like your kids wanting to be artists, right? Like when I wanted to be a writer, my parents loved me, but they were not interested. They didn't like it. It felt frivolous. When I said I wanted to get an MFA, you know what my dad said? He said, you know, your problem is you never had to pick cotton. And I said, Daddy, for me, that's not exactly a problem. And he said, no, because when you have to pick cotton, you don't say, am I challenged by the cotton? You don't say, oh, my goodness, this cotton does not recognize my complexity. You don't say, this cotton is not my niche. He said, you just pick the damn cotton. And he felt that me wanting to get my degree in creative writing was I was rejecting all the sacrifices, not that his sacrifices had yielded this spoiled child who didn't understand work. And I think the same is happening with Celestial and her parents and Roy and his parents and her marriage. She's saying, I'm not fulfilled. This situation is not allowing me to be my full self. I want to be happy. And her parents, everyone is looking at her like, what is this happy that you want? You just do your work. You just do the support that you're here to do. Like they don't understand the next generation is a daughter who wants to be fulfilled. I think Roy's parents are different than Celestial's parents, not so much because of their class background, but because it's their son that's in prison, right? They want everyone to support their son who's in prison. Like I would imagine if, I sometimes say if the tables were turned, but as Roy says, those tables can't turn, I don't think his mother would be lobbying for him to be supportive of her. She wants both the mothers want what's best for their child. But I do think that one thing about those parents, did you notice that all those parents in the book, they all came to their marriages sideways, right? Like Celestial's daddy was married to a whole different person when he met Celestial's mother. Yeah, he's up here trying to be the marriage police, telling people what they need to do. Roy's mother, you know, she had a baby back when people thought that was a scandal, and yet she married another man who raised Roy as his own. But they also want to be the traditional marriage police. I feel like people love traditional marriages for other people.
What time is it in New York?
It's 35 after.
Perfect. We can take about two more questions.
Hi.
Hi.
It's been a pleasure listening to your talk. I really enjoyed it. One of the things that drew me here was hearing you talk about the Southern experience, and I'll just make a very brief statement, which is I moved back here to the United States from Brazil, where I was brought up as a kid, into Northern Virginia. And it was 1976 and a very challenging time living in Northern Virginia, where my neighbors, where I lived, were mostly black. And the school I went to was mostly white, with a lot of black kids who were bussed in. And it was a challenge. I didn't understand the social cues that intended to be racist, and from the white kids, and the anger in the black kids responding to it. And I'm curious, what's your experience now with like the new sort of what I see as racism, which is gentrification, and you were touching on it in Atlanta, where you're moving back to, you know, how is that city surviving that? Because here it's very painful, I have to say.
I moved to Atlanta from New York, and you know, when you live in New York and you tell people you're from the South, because people use the American South as shorthand for, you know, black unhappiness, black misery. I often say that when I was in New York, when I was in Brooklyn, I would tell people I was from Georgia, and they would act like I got to Brooklyn on the Underground Railroad, you know? But I actually find it easier to be black in Atlanta than I did to be black in New York. And I think it's a lot of factors. I think Atlanta in particular, because we have that critical mass of black people that, as a black person living the type of life I live, I feel fortunate, but I don't feel like an exception. And I think that is just important for my day-to-day. But Atlanta is becoming gentrified. Like, it's just like D.C., how they say that D.C. is no longer a chocolate city. Atlanta is not a black city in the way that it used to be, and that people are being displaced because, you know, people, Atlanta is the city, you know, we have a lot of traffic and a lot of sprawl in Atlanta, and Atlanta's sprawl is white flight. When I was a kid, Stone Mountain, Georgia, which is about 15 miles from where I live now, was all white. It has a big mountain. It's like Mount Rushmore for the Confederacy, like Robert E. Lee and them are carved into the mountain. I don't know what we're going to do, but you can't get rid of the mountain. You know how, like, in all the other cities, they're taking down their Confederate. I don't know what are we going to do about Stone Mountain. I do not know. But anyway, I mean, because it's a mountain. But because of white flight, black people moved out of the city, too, and Stone Mountain is pretty much all black now. And so then the white people have moved further out. They're almost all the way out to Tennessee, to Chattanooga. And that's why traffic is so bad in Atlanta. You know, we have that notorious traffic, but it's about white flight. And so now people from the suburbs are coming back into the city, and they're displacing people. I'm sure this is happening here. There are people who have modest homes that they're so proud of. They've kept up all their lives. And now, like, their parents are retiring and they want to sell their house, and they're told that their home is a teardown. This house that they've meant so much to them, that they just want, the people want to buy two of them, knock them down, and put a big house on that place. And it has been very painful to watch, but I'm not quite sure what there is for average citizens to do. And I don't know my own role in it, because I live in a house in the city that was not there when I was growing up. Somebody else's house had to be there before my house was built, and I live there. So am I part of the problem? People tell me that, no, you're a local girl made good coming home. We're so proud of you. And I know that they are proud of me, but I have to ask myself, who lived there before me? I don't know.
One last question. I think there's somebody.
This will be a light one.
Oh, thank you.
I understand your book has been optioned.
Yes.
Okay. Do you have any ideas or any actors or actresses in mind to play particular parts? I certainly do.
Okay. Tell me. Tell me who do you think should do what?
Well, when I think of Celestial, I think about, she's a little old now, but Viola Davis, excuse me, but she's a little old for that. But I'm interested in hearing your ideas.
Okay, so this option thing, this is all new to me. I don't have ideas for the main characters because of the age thing. Everyone I think of is too old, but I have an excellent idea for her parents. You ready? What do you think about... Oh, my goodness, her name just popped out of my head. Okay, what do you think about Angela Bassett and her real-life husband?
Yeah.
How adorable is that? Okay, so that's my idea. And then you know who I think should be Roy's cellmate?
Who's that?
Eddie Murphy.
Oh, okay.
Isn't that good? So I try to only think about the small roles, because whoever they cast in the big roles, I don't want that person to think I don't like them. But... I'm not writing a screenplay because I don't know how, and I don't want to practice on my big moment, but I was thinking that maybe I wanted to write the screenplay. But then I met with the screenplay person, and she told me, she thinks she's going to have to make some changes, particularly to the ending of the book. And I was like, don't worry, I'm not going to spoil it. But I was like, wait, no, you can't. And she said, look, this book ends primarily with someone having a change of heart, having an epiphany. And she says, in a movie, that people have to do something, because somebody having an epiphany looks like this. She was like, you can't end the movie like that, girl. You cannot. She's like, the people got to go do something. And when she said that, I realized that, okay, I'm going to stay in my lane, and I'm going to let her do, you know, what she's going to do in her lane. But she and I, we did have one little tussle, which is this. I don't know if y'all noticed it, but did you all notice that I did not identify the race of the woman who accused Roy? Like, can I take a poll right quick? Do I have permission?
No, please.
How many people thought she was white? Look at that hand just went up. How many people thought she was black? How many people never noticed it until I told you right now? So I said, so the screenwriter said, we're going to have to cast somebody in that role. And I was like, well, can't we just, you know, leave her in the shadows? And she was like, no, we can't. She's like, that's another novel trick that doesn't work, in a movie. I know what I think, but I am very curious to see how it plays out in the movie. Jennifer Lewis for his mother? Oh, that's not bad.
Her name slipped my mind, but Kerry Washington, of course, for Celestial.
Too old.
Kerry Washington, too old?
We need somebody about the age of Beth from This Is Us.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
About that age. But you know what? What do you think about Jill Scott for Davina?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, I think we should end on that high note. Thank you very much, everybody.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.